It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
We're not talking about morality here. We're talking about legal ethics. So, for instance, if I, as an attorney, failed to perform a particular function in a piece of representation, and I do that only one time as an example, I may have forgotten to do it, I may have made a mistake of not doing it, but that doesn't necessarily amount to an issue under legal ethics. But if there's a series of things in a piece of representation that I forget to do, that gets closer to the mark, and it would be something that the bar would look at.
Virginia State Bar Counsel Harry Hirst explains attorney discipline in Virginia and when and how to file a complaint about lawyer misconduct, and a step-by-step analysis of how to petition for child custody or visitation is discussed during this week's question and answer session. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 95, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's news you can use. Last month, the Financial Reform Bill finally passed. It includes procedures to ensure that shareholders and creditors, not taxpayers, bear the losses when big financial institutions fail. New capital requirements for banks, curbs to quell speculative excess, regulation of derivatives, and restrictions on proprietary trading. The bill had to withstand a lobbying juggernaut. According to the Center for Responsive Politics, since January 2009, the financial sector spent nearly $600 million to weaken reform. But the lobbyists lost, especially on consumer protection. The new Consumer Financial Protection Agency not only has the power to rectify lending abuses, but also will recognize that the safety and soundness of banks can't be measured by profitability alone, but by the impact that bank practices may have on consumers. However, supporters still have another fight ahead of them over implementing the bill. Regulators now must write hundreds of rules and conduct dozens of studies, largely outside of public view. And some of the regulatory bodies, such as the Federal Reserve Board, still are run by the same people who were blind as the financial crisis developed. In other news, the Commonwealth Institute for Fiscal Analysis has released their latest report analyzing the new health care reform law and its impact on Virginia. While many of the new reforms are already underway, officials in Virginia now are looking ahead to the 2014 expansion of the Medicaid program. The report documents how Virginia will benefit from Medicaid expansion and examines the estimates on who will gain coverage and the potential cost to the state. The report finds that Virginia currently has more restrictive Medicaid eligibility for parents than 42 other states, including every neighboring state. Up to 425,000 Virginians could gain health insurance under the expansion of Medicaid. And the federal government will pay 100% of the cost of the Medicaid expansion from 2014 to 2016, and 95% in 2017, falling to 90% in 2020 and beyond. The future expansion of Medicaid will greatly benefit Virginia, as hundreds of thousands of uninsured Virginians gain access to health insurance, mostly paid for by the federal government. The complete report is available at www.thecommonwealthinstitute.org. With this week's News You Can Use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
It's time for the answers to our weekly quiz called, Is That Legal? Last week, we gave you a legal question and three possible answers, one of which was incorrect. Here's last week's question. Which two sources of income can a creditor who has a judgment garnish? A. After-tax wages greater than $290 per week. B. Child support. Or C. Spousal support. The correct answers are A. After-tax wages greater than $290 per week. And C. Spousal support. Child support legally is the income and property of the child, not the parent, and can't be taken to pay the parent's debt or judgments. Later in the show, we'll give you this week's quiz. Is that legal? For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Diane Dussault.
You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio. It's time for this week's question and answer. We're here in the studio with this week's questioner. Please tell us your name and where you're from.
Shalisha from Highland Springs.
Welcome to the show, Shalisha. What question do we have this week?
My question is about child support, child visitation, and child custody. The question is, if someone thinks that someone else is the father of their child, and they find out that another man is the father, how do they go about getting visitation and custody or joint custody if the mother wouldn't let them see the child?
Has the paternity of the child been determined? That is, has there been some court order saying who is the father?
Yes.
And is that the person who would be seeking child custody or visitation, or would it be another person?
The biological father.
Well, in that situation, it's fairly straightforward. The biological father can simply go down to the court services unit for the juvenile and domestic relations court for the city or county where the child lives and file either a petition for custody or a petition for visitation, or both. There is a $25 fee for each petition, but if you can't afford the fee, you can ask the court for a form. I believe it's called Form DC-606. That allows you to file the case for free if you can't afford the filing fee and the judge allows it. The court will set a hearing date. Usually it's a couple of months away. And that first hearing date is really what we call a status conference. It doesn't result in a final order. It's not a long hearing. It's maybe about a 10 or 15 minute hearing at most. During that time, the court would issue probably a temporary order and definitely would issue an order that the parties, if they have not already done so, go to parenting class. This is required by Virginia law and has been for a number of years. Anybody who is involved in a child custody or child visitation case must go to parenting class, and they'll be given a list of agencies that offer the parenting class. It's about a four-hour class. There's a fairly small fee for that. It, again, can be reduced or even eliminated if you can't afford it. And then after the parties have gone to the parenting class and done anything else that the court required, and there may be other things the court can do. The court can appoint an attorney for the children called a guardian ad litem. The court can order visits by a court-appointed special advocate or CASA worker. The court can even order a home study by the Department of Social Services, or if there are allegations of unfitness, order psychological examinations. The court can send the case to mediation to see if the parties can work it out amongst themselves. But eventually, after all that's taken place, the court will have a final hearing, usually lasts a lot longer than the preliminary or first hearing, and allow the parties to state their cases and make a decision. Now, realistically, someone who has not seen the child very much and has not had the child in his or her care is not likely to get child custody. They are, however, very likely to get child visitation because it took two parents to bring a child into the world, and the child has a right to visit with both parents, and both parents have a right to have contact with the child. So if this person has not already filed for child custody or child visitation, I would encourage them to do that.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
We're here at the offices of the Virginia State Bar, and we are talking to Deputy Bar Counsel Harry Hirsch about lawyer discipline in Virginia. Welcome to the show, Harry.
Thank you.
Could you tell our listeners, Harry, in general, how are lawyers disciplined in Virginia?
The Bar, which is the Virginia State Bar, is an entity of the Supreme Court of Virginia. For purposes of the disciplinary function, the Bar is an administrative agency of the Supreme Court of Virginia, and the disciplinary process, which is authorized by the court for implementation by the Bar, is how lawyers are primarily disciplined in Virginia.
Now, how is the process started by somebody who believes that a lawyer has done something wrong?
Well, a citizen would make a report to the Bar, and that can be done in writing by letter, it can be done by email, it can be done by fax. You can find the contact information at vsb.org, virginiastatebar.org. There is a section there of information for the public, and one of them gives you a link to filing a misconduct complaint.
Now, what type of things can a person complain about? What type of things are fair grounds for the Virginia State Bar to look at to determine if some lawyer has committed misconduct?
Well, that's an interesting way to phrase the question. From my perspective, we receive, obviously, as I said, complaints from the public. Since the public is not familiar with a body of law called the Virginia Rules of Professional Conduct, which are the rules that we enforce in the disciplinary system, we don't ask that the individual filing the complaint state a case per se. So I think in answer to your question, perhaps the best way to answer it is to describe what a typical complaint might be. In a civil or criminal case, a client or a lawyer or a judge may write in or notify us that there's a lack of communication between the client and the attorney. There may be something which the person making the report thinks should have occurred in a piece of representation or in a case that they believe did not occur, and they believe that that was something which the attorney should have done, and so they might report that. The bottom line of it is that a person would file a bar complaint if they believe that something has occurred or failed to occur in their representation that they think either should have occurred or shouldn't have occurred.
Now, I know the state bar gets thousands of complaints a year, and roughly about 1,000 of these are investigated, and roughly several hundred result in some form of attorney discipline. So a lot of the complaints that are made, they may be some legitimate gripe there, but they don't really violate those rules that you describe, the rules of professional conduct. So what type of things do people complain about that, as I said, they may be a valid complaint, but it's nothing that you can do anything about?
What we're talking about is a concept known as legal ethics. And legal ethics are to be differentiated from what the reporting citizen might call morality. We're not talking about morality here. We're talking about legal ethics. So, for instance, if I, as an attorney, failed to perform a particular function in a piece of representation, and I do that only one time, as an example, I may have forgotten to do it, I may have made a mistake of not doing it, but that doesn't necessarily amount to an issue under legal ethics. But if there's a series of things in a piece of representation that I forget to do, that gets closer to the mark, and it would be something that the bar would look at. Basically, as I said, we don't ask complainants to know the rules of professional conduct, and so when we receive a complaint, we have to then look at it and try to determine what it is that the complainant is trying to tell us concerning their perception of what has or has not occurred, and then try to see if we can fit that into the parameters of what we enforce.
Tell us the types of things that people really bring to the state bar, but are things that don't violate the...
Well, the example that I always use, which I think is probably a little more comical than anything else, but it does make the point. If a complainant reports to the bar that the attorney they hired had brown hair, let's say, and 3 weeks after the attorney started working on the case, the attorney's hair turned gray. If the complainant writes in and says, my attorney's hair turned gray, that's not a basis for a complaint. And so there is a process by which inquiries that we receive are sorted out to cut out of the system and to prevent getting into the system those matters which really have nothing to do with the rules of professional conduct.
Now, the final question, I guess, is this. Virginia has a system of self-regulation where these various committees that you describe are actually appointed by the bar, by something called the Bar Council. And so attorneys are allowed essentially to regulate themselves. Criticism that's often made is that this is putting the fox in charge of the hen house. Your response?
Well, the participants in the system, the volunteers, the 190 volunteers I just described, are composed of members of what is known as a disciplinary board and 17 district committee panels. The district committee panels cover the state of Virginia, and they are more localized. The disciplinary board hears cases from all over the state, and that's the entity which can revoke or suspend a license. The district committees cannot suspend or revoke. I mention that because the Supreme Court of Virginia actually appoints the members of the disciplinary board. The members of the district committees are elected by the Virginia State Bar Council. The district committee members generally sit on cases which occur within a geographic area which is pretty local to where they practice, as opposed to the board. The response I would make to your question is that what we're enforcing is a set of rules which are not common knowledge to the general public, and that's consistent with the idea that the average member of the public is not a lawyer. And so that being the case, the peers of the lawyer are the lawyers. The principal way we meet your observation, though, is through the inclusion of laypeople in the disciplinary process at every decision stage, as I mentioned. And the interesting thing, and I've done this for more years than I care to admit, the interesting aspect of the involvement of laypeople is that they provide a wonderful perspective to the process and the results of the process, which provide a perspective that I would generally categorize as common sense. And an example I often use goes back to one of the first disciplinary hearings I ever heard when I first started this work, and it was a multi-day district committee hearing. And the layperson hearing the case as a member of the panel said nothing for 2 days. And the morning of the third day, this person asked a question. And of course, usually that this is not an unusual preface to a question by a layperson during a hearing. It's, you know, I'm just a layperson. But let me throw this at. And this person said, you know, back on day one, we started out talking about point A. And then we spent all day, day one, all day on day two. And here we are about to start day three. We've been talking about Z, not A. Can one of you lawyers explain to me why we started talking about A and now for hours on end we've been talking about Z? Where is the connection? And everybody's human, including lawyers. And so what immediately occurred was that a light bulb went off. You just could see it in the panel members. This layperson was absolutely correct. The lawyers had gotten bogged down, if you will, in the minutiae of certain legal issues. But the layperson, not burdened with those issues, had the common sense to say, hey, the issue was A. Let's get back to A. That's what she was really saying. And I think that's a classic example of how wonderful the contributions of lay people are. And that's particularly the case when you realize that, number one, they're volunteering. Number two, they don't have a law license, and they don't have any other interest in the hunt, if you will. And they do this out of public service, and they spend untold hours doing it. It's really a tremendous asset of the bar's disciplinary system, and they are a tremendous contribution to it.
And so ultimately, the public helps protect the public.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Thank you very much. We have been talking with Virginia State Bar Deputy Counsel Harry Hirsch about lawyer discipline in Virginia. Thank you so much for being on the show.
My pleasure.
Welcome back to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
It's time for our weekly quiz called, Is That Legal? We give you a legal question and three possible answers, one of which is incorrect, and we give the correct answers next week. If you're the first to email the two correct answers, we'll post your name on our show's website and send you a free copy of the Virginia State Bar's Handbook on Your Legal Rights and Responsibilities. Here's this week's question. Which two documents generally will give an employee legal enforceable rights? A, an employment contract. B, a union contract. Or C, a personnel manual. If you know the two correct answers, email them by Friday to marty@cvlas.org and be next week's winner. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Michelle King.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-6046. 866-1012 to call toll-free. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid radio show ever broadcast is now available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral 4, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wegbright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. When you make a major purchase, the manufacturer or seller makes an important promise to stand behind the product. It's called a warranty. Join us next week when consumer protection attorney Patty Anderson talks about consumer warranties, when they apply, and how to enforce them. That's Law for the Rest of Us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegbright.